The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
So I'm giving this class for Gong Chen, and I'm a guest lecturer, and I'm actually going to reappear. I'm going to do a different lecture on a totally different topic. But he told me that I was supposed to do carbon nanotubes in one lecture. So this will be quite fast because there's a lot to say. And I'm going to try to skim over the main issues so you get some idea about carbon nanotubes as a kind of model system for one-dimensional phenomena. So I start out with an overview, and then I have a lot of other things. And I recommend, there's a book over here that I'm a co-author of, that if you want to have a textbook on the subject, that's the one that most people use nowadays. And I always apologize about it. We're so busy, we don't have time to do the next edition. It's been through many printings. And it should be brought up to date because so much has happened in the last few years. It will come back again. I show it on all the outlines. So, okay, I'm going to start out with a little bit of an overview here. And so what is a nanotube and why is it interesting? That's what this one view graph does, the whole overview. So a nanotube is something like this. It has a hole in the middle, and there are carbon atoms, one atom thick, on the circumference of the cylinder. And you could think of making the nanotube by taking a sheet of graphite. So this is just one single layer, atomic layer thin, of graphite. And then you roll this thing up in a seamless way. And that's always possible in a periodic lattice. So you get a cylinder that's like that, one atom thick. And it could be very, very long. You can have a length to a diameter ratio of as much as 10 to the fifth, 100,000 times. So it could be very varied. And one of the reasons Gong wanted me to talk about this here is it's a model system for nanoscience, and it's being also considered for nanotechnology. They can be very small. The smallest nanotube is 4/10 of 1 nanometer, only 10 atoms in circumference. So that is about the smallest solid-state system in existence. The electronic properties are very varied, depending on how you roll this thing up, and I'll go through that very briefly. Everything has to be brief. I'll explain how it is that you can get metallic and semiconducting nanotubes. So that depends, the same diameter almost, just slight variation, but the way you roll it up is what determines that property. And mechanical properties, so this is mechanical engineering, mechanical properties are excellent, both in terms of stiffness and strength, especially according to weight, and that's derived from graphite from which it comes. Oh, by the way, folks, you don't have to be too pedantic about copying everything because I'm going to make this available to you on the website, the class website. If Arvind, you'll put this on the website, then they don't have to furiously copy because it'll be impossible to keep up with me. And it acts like that is the tube. So this is, say, the tube. It acts like an electromagnetic antenna with the electric field this way along the axis of the tube. And it's an excellent thermal conductor, the best that there is. So people are thinking about many applications. And in our group, we do single molecule spectroscopy with it. But we do other things too. So now, next thing I'm going to say how people make them. Yes. A nanochain. Yeah, well, a nanochain could be something different because a nanochain could be just a string of single atoms. you could imagine that. It doesn't exactly occur in nature all by itself, but it could occur in an array. There's such a thing as one-dimensional graphite chains, and most of that comes in from outer space. But it's not a nanotube. They're just a lot of them, and they form a kind of a lattice.
Can you make a nanotube?
I guess you can.
And how is it?
But nobody has made that exactly yet. Well, what they make is a series of carbon atoms, a few atoms thick, and it's long, and that's called a nanographite. And there are ways of making that experimentally. But you could imagine you just take a sheet and you cut it into a thin strip. That's available experimentally and it's studied, but only very, very few groups around the world study that. But there is such a thing as that. That's different from the other thing. It's not one atom thick. All right. So next I'm going to talk about synthesis. And I'm going to try to go pretty fast to get through all the topics on that list. So there are different ways of synthesizing it. An arc discharge means that you have a high voltage between two electrodes. So here are two electrodes, an anode and a cathode. And we're talking of putting either high volts or a high current flowing across in the discharge. Now, well, here's the conditions in which they grow them. And, there's just a whole lot of papers on this going back as long as this, but into the present. And then another way is to make it with a laser. So here's a laser. That's the laser impinges on a graphite surface and a plume of atoms in the vapor phase come off and they somehow get together in the furnace. So this is the way the experiment is done. The synthesis is done, so inside this tube. So here's the tube that's operated at about 1,000 degrees C. Here's the temperature range. And so there's flowing gas, and these particles, when they deposit, they're nanotubes on a cold surface, and you collect them. So that's kind of two ways. And the third way is from the vapor phase, chemical vapor deposition. And this is the method of making large quantities of it. People prefer some of the older techniques because they say that the sample is more perfect and it has less defects. I think that with the vapor phase, the very best work that has been done is as good as what you can do with arc discharge or a laser. But anyway, we like those samples that are made in the vapor phase because we can deposit individual nanotubes on, a silicon surface, or we can prepare them between some posts. I'll show you that later, isolated, so we could study individual nanotubes. That's what we do in our group. We study one nanotube at a time. Now, in the bundles of nanotubes that are made by arc discharge or vapor deposition, they look like this to the eye when the sample is made. And when you pull out one of these threads from this, that thread is a rope that looks like this, and it contains many nanotubes. Each one of those circles is a single individual nanotube. So this is a single crystal composed of many nanotubes, and you can see it has a crystalline lattice. So that's the way arc discharge and laser vaporization, they produce samples that look like this, basically. And the vapor phase produces samples that look like this, or they can look like trees growing in a forest. I'll show you that later. And to make individual nanotubes, you have to use a catalytic particle. So because of that, if you lay your catalytic particle on a surface, that can determine where the nanotube will grow. So that gives you the location of the growth of the nanotube. To determine and control the diameter of the nanotube, two main parameters are used. One is temperature, and the other is a furnace condition. So catalyst that's used, the vapor pressure, the gases that are flowing, all of those things affect what grows. And you can tell what you've made by measuring these spectra. So these are Raman spectra, and the frequency here, from the frequency, you can determine the diameter of the individual tubes contained in your sample. And the formula that gives you the diameter, so here's the diameter of the tube. Tube diameter is that what stands for. And it goes like 1 over the frequency that's measured over here. So by looking at this, you can get the diameter and diameter distribution according to the heights of the peaks. So that tells you about your sample. And that's the standard way people calibrate and understand their samples. The smallest nanotube is the one that's 4/10 of a nanometer. So here's 4/10 of a nanometer. And I'll explain this notation in a little while. This particular nanotube has only 10 carbon atoms. If you pick up here, you can see one of those nanotubes right over there on a substrate. It's very hard to find them, but that's what's published in the literature. And the work is done in Hong Kong. There's a gentleman that made the measurements. And they have a lot of different measurements on the smallest nanotube because it's so spectacular. And it goes superconducting at low temperatures. So that's amazing. It's just carbon atoms. There's nothing else. It wasn't exactly expected that you would have a superconductor, but that's what you have. And another thing you can do with the nanotubes is you can fill them with different things. So here they're filled with fullerenes. Here's a nanotube, and inside the nanotube is a wire. Somebody asked me about a wire of different things. So this is a carbon wire made of fullerenes. So you have fullerenes at the spacing that fullerenes are in crystalline fullerenes. And here is the electronic structure. So the electronic structure of a nanotube, the empty nanotube, is not so different from what it is filled. But if you look here, you'll see some differences right around here and right around here. Right at the Fermi level itself, they look almost similar. So, and here's how you make them. So you have an ampule here that contains nanotubes on a substrate. They call that Bucky paper. It's a paper that contains fullerenes. And it contains nanotubes. And on that paper containing nanotubes, it's exposed to the fullerenes. And the hollow of the nanotube, so the nanotube is like this, and the fullerene will fit inside the nanotube. So it will go inside the nanotube when the whole thing is heated, as you can see over here. And this is the end result. So here are fullerenes inside nanotubes. You could see them with high-resolution TEM. And there are different things that are happening. So if you heat it or do something to it, go up in temperature, they start attracting one another. So you could see that here they're equally spaced, and here they become less equally spaced. And then over here they start coalescing, and eventually you go up to about 1,000 degrees. They form an inner wire inside the outer wire. So that's one way of making double-wall nanotubes. That's what I say over here. Make double-wall nanotubes. And some of the best double-wall nanotubes are made by this process. So that's what I'm going to say. Yes?
How can people purify the nanotubes with the fullerene?
How can you what?
Purify from, like, when you put the fullerenes inside the nanotubes, how can you purify your result?
You start out with purified fullerenes. You start out with purified nanotubes. The yield is not 100%, no.
So at the end, is there a way to separate?
Is to separate them? We don't have, I'm going to get to separation later in the class, and we don't have really good ways of separating everything, but we might have some ways of separating some things. And I can give you some recipes. By and large, a sample of so-called these pea pods that have the tube inside as fullerenes, the sample will have other things in it. But there are a couple of examples in the literature so far of authors who have managed to make a sample that has a very high content of say, double-wall nanotubes. I don't know that anybody's made a sample that's pure pea pods. But it may be, if you look carefully enough in the literature. I don't know all the papers. I know most of them, but I don't know all of them. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to talk about is structures and symmetry. In this view graph, I define distinguish different fullerenes. Okay, now this looks like a lot of math, but why am I bothering you with this? It's important to understand that fullerenes can be metallic or semiconducting, and this picture gives the key to determine when you have a metallic fullerene and when you have a semiconducting fullerene, and it gives you the key for identifying, distinguishing one nanotube from another nanotube, because every nanotube, according to these NM indices, here's an NM index right here. Everybody uses this notation. And it was very lucky that we wrote the book very early in the nanotube business, so we got everybody to use our notation that way. So it's a kind of uniform notation in the literature, and that's very, very helpful in reading papers, because there are many ways you could define the nanotubes. You could imagine just looking at the picture. Okay, so what do we do? So this is a corner of a hexagon. You see a lot of hexagons here? This is the hexagon that have to do with graphite. I told you that to make a nanotube, we start out with a graphene sheet, one sheet of graphite. So the hexagons pertain to a layer plane of graphite. At each vertex of the hexagon is one carbon atom. Okay, so here's the position of one carbon atom. Here's a position of another carbon atom. This distance from O to A is called the chiral vector, C sub H. And that distance, OA, when it rolls up, forms the circumference of the tube. So that's a very important distance. Now, the other distance that's very important is the distance from O along a normal to OA. So we make a normal to OA, perpendicular, and the first point of intersection is the lattice vector of the nanotube. So we have the graphene layer itself has this unit cell. I'm sure that Professor Chen explained what a unit cell is, because that's the fundamental unit for all crystal structures. And so these are the basis functions. There are two atoms in the unit cell of graphite. Here is one of them at this vertex, and here's the second one. You can call them atoms A and B. Those are two that are distinguished from each other. And so the unit cell is this parallelepiped that I show over here, and it has A1 and A2. So this length, OA, it has 1, 2, 3, 4 of the A1s and 1, 2 of the A2s. So we call this one a 4-2 nanotube. Okay? I should have put it on the view graph, but I didn't. And this vector T, this is the translation vector of the unit cell, and it has capital N number of hexagons contained therein, which I'm going to show you the formula of how you get that. And these are the components of T1 and T2 in the A1 and A2 directions. And you can get this geometrically. I'm not going to spend time with doing that. And the definition determining of the how this is, what is my problem here? Operator, I have lamp runtime. I don't know what that is. Is that me or you?
I think it will just go away.
Okay, good. So D sub R is the largest, greatest common denominator. That means that it's the largest integer that the two components here are divisible by. This is a mathematical term, and that's necessary to determine these T1s and T2s. So that's the formula. And next I'm going to show you some symmetry of the tubes. So those tubes that have N and M are like this, and they have edges that look like armchairs. They look like chairs. You could sit on that chair. Anyway, we call that armchair. And this one here, zigzag, where this is N and 0, looks like zigzag back and forth. And all the others, you can see a chiral angle going round and round. Can you see that? So these two, top two, are what we call symorphic crystals. That means that in solid-state physics, we have something called space groups. I don't know if Professor Chen mentioned anything about that. But you know about translations. If you have a unit cell, if you go take a unit cell and you translate it by a lattice vector, you get the same unit cell translated. For symorphic crystals, the rotations and the translations are independent of one another. So the two nanotubes that you can make that have that property are armchair and zigzag, and all other nanotubes have a chirality to them, and the rotations and the translations are coupled. The symmetry operations are a combination of translations and rotations. I don't have to get into that, but that's very important in many of the properties of nanotubes. So if any of you do research in this, you might want to know something more about that. So what I show here is something more about the chiral angles and the diameters. In the laboratory, when you measure the structure of these nanotubes, say by STM or something like that, what you measure is the diameter and the chiral angle directly. I'll show you that in a moment. And so here's the chiral angle. It's the angle that the chiral vector makes with the A1 direction. So that's theta chiral angle. And the diameter is this circumference divided by pi. So that's just a simple geometrical formula that you're familiar with. All right, now here's how we measure them. So here's a nanotube that's kind of stretched out a little bit, and this is the substrate. So if we go along with an STM, scanning tunneling microscopy tip, many of you have used this in your laboratory work. As you go along here on the surface, you'll be right on the surface, but when you get up to this point, all of a sudden you have a nanotube, so that the point of the tip will rise up, and the maximum distance that it rises up gives you the diameter of the tube. So that's the way that's found. And the chiral angle can be seen on the STM in terms of these hexagons. You could see the hexagons along the axis of the nanotube in this direction, and the angle that the hexagons make with the nanotube axis itself gives you the complement of the chiral angle, 90 degrees minus the chiral angle. So that's one thing. Then we have something else that's called scanning tunneling spectroscopy, STS. On the view graphs, I put a lot of these kind of notations. We added them, and Ming helped me add a few. Because some of these terms wouldn't be familiar with the students in the class. So I added a lot of stuff like that for you. And if I've missed some, I'm sorry, so tell me and I'll add them for you. Now, well, I would like you to look over here. This shows you the constant energy surfaces and that you see a point K. I'm going to show you in a moment. K is in reciprocal space, and here's the point K. And in graphite, K is the place where the valence and conduction bands come together in one point. That's why nanotubes are very, very special materials, and they have special properties because the valence and conduction bands touch at only one point in the Brillouin zone. And that makes it a zero-gap semiconductor because the two bands, conduction and valence band, have only one point in common, and that's the K point. So we start making constant energy surfaces. So the point K is at energy zero because the Fermi level goes through point K. Have you had Fermi level? Yeah, okay, so you know what that is. So here we are at point K, so that's where the Fermi level sits, and all of these contours at constant energy give you energies above zero. So the bigger the contour, the higher the energy. And you'll see they start out as circles for small energy. But when you get out here, like 1 or 2 electron volts from the center, you see that the constant energy surfaces are warped. And you could see a threefold symmetry. And that has to do with graphite. Now, why am I bothering you with all of this? The reason why nanotubes are each different from another is because of this warping, this anisotropy. Because of that, every molecule is distinguishable from every other molecule, and we could actually measure the properties of each individual molecule according to their energy levels, which we can determine because of these small differences. So that's the reason you have to be sensitive to this picture. This picture is a very, very key point, and it's the basis how we can do spectroscopy on just one nanotube. You have to understand that picture to be able to understand spectra. And why do we want to do spectroscopy? Attaching leads to a nanotube changes the nanotube because leads are injecting carriers. You cannot attach a metal to a nanotube without transferring charge. So putting contacts on a nanotube changes the nanotube, so we don't have the nanotube that we started with. But optics is a very weak probe, so it doesn't change the properties of nanotubes. Yeah? Okay, yeah, okay, very good. So this is the K point, and you have to look here where the symmetry is. Okay, it's right around here. I could see some symmetry where the threefold axis goes. And so they're just K directions. I'll show you that later. I'll show you that schematically. And as you go away from the K point, it's energy. Okay? And this way, its directions are K. And this part here is STS measurements. So that's taken here. This is zero of energy. So zero of energy would correspond to the K point. And then we have the probe that has some voltage with respect to the ground. So that energy corresponds to the energy away from the K point. So we can probe the positions where the molecule, I say each nanotube is a molecule, so it will have energy levels. So there are spikes here, and each of the spikes have to do with the energy levels of the molecule that we're looking at. And so you have a few different nanotubes here, the 12-6 molecule. And the 12-6 molecule is supposed to have these energy levels, and here are the experiments, and you can match them up. All right? That's what that is. Okay, well, moving right along here, I have 25 minutes. I should finish structure very, very quickly here. So this is about reciprocal space, and be quick about this. So you know that if you have real space, you have reciprocal space, and the vectors in reciprocal space times the vectors in real space is equal to 2 pi for each component. And so we use that same definition. So here's the vector in real space and the vector in reciprocal space, and the product is 2 pi. So if the unit vector in real space gets bigger, then the unit vector in reciprocal space gets smaller because the product is always a number. Okay, so that kind of defines your translation vectors in real and reciprocal space. And you can see that when we have the K2 direction, so the K2 direction is parallel to T, so that along the K2 direction, so that's sort of the wire axis, nanotube axis, and so we have a continuum of states. So that's just like a crystal. There are many, many states, billions of states along that direction. But normal to this, where you have 10 atoms, you have 10 states. So they're very, very heavily quantized. And that's why people like nanotubes, because you see quantum mechanics in its essence. And what's shown here are the cutting lines, and each cutting line corresponds to one of these allowed K vectors. This particular figure was made for the 4-2 nanotube. So here we have quite a few atoms still in the unit cell. It's not 10. But it's something a little bit more than that. And so you could see each of these going from the beginning point to the end point. That gives you the totality. There are 28 of those cutting lines. You'll count them up there if you want to, and you'll find 28 of them. And that explains what's going on. All right. So now I'm going to tell you about the electronic properties. So we just covered now the structures and symmetry, okay? And we were wrapping up these nanotubes. We could make armchairs, zigzag, chiral nanotubes. And then we had something about their symmetry, that they have rotations. Sometimes they have inversion symmetry. Those that are asymmorphic will have inversion symmetry. The others don't have inversion symmetry. But they have some kind of rotational thing that goes around on the chiral plane, when you follow the atoms on the chiral chain. Okay, next I'm going to talk a little bit about electronic properties. So I should finish electronic properties, transport, and a little bit of phonons by 2 o'clock, maybe mostly. So 10 minutes each. All right, so let's explain. I had some of this already. This picture is graphite. Here's the unit cell of graphite. And in reciprocal space, it looks very similar. And now somebody asked, what's label? Remember you asked me label? Here's the labels. So this is the central point, which is k equals 0. So we call that gamma always. And here's the k point where the valence and conduction band touch. So you make your constant energy surfaces with respect to this point. Okay? And now if you go and finish your hexagon around this point, you get to the M point, which is the center of the side. The K point is at a point, and the M point is at the middle of the, what do we call that? There's six sides of the hexagon, so it's the middle of the side. Okay, now the K point is over here. You could see here's the K point, because that's the touching of the, here's the conduction band, here's the valence band, here's the K point that touches, and the M point is halfway between them. Okay, so you could see that. So here's gamma K and gamma M, and here are the constant energy surfaces, and everything is degenerate at the point K, like I said. So you could see all of that. And I think that you had a homework problem, or so you read one of our papers. I think Gong told me that he gave us a homework problem to do tight binding for a single sheet of graphite. Did you have that? He told me that he gave you that. And you came up with this formula. He said that you knew this formula. This is a potato. Okay. When I teach solid-state physics, I don't teach in the mechanical engineering department, but I teach solid-state physics around MIT. I have been doing that for many years. And so we give this as an example for a tight binding approximation. Two reasons. One, it's very modern, and two, it's very simple. So, okay, so this is graphite itself. Infinite plane of hexagons. And with an atom at each point of the hexagon. That's the crystal structure, and that's the energy, E versus K. It comes out very, very simply by tight binding approximation. And now, when you have a nanotube, you don't have a flat surface, but what you do is you take the tube and you roll it up so that this point and this point are identical. So that means if you go around 2 pi, you come back to home. Because the point 0 and the point 2 pi, they have to be the same point. So imposing that boundary condition, you get the energy eigenvalues. And this is something that we do all the time in solid-state physics to get the dispersion relations, and we do it also for nanotubes. So it's shown or demonstrated over here. So here's 2 pi times an integer. So that tells you, we come back, we differ by 0 times 2 pi, 1 times 2 pi, 2 times 2 pi, etc. That makes the circle. And then the thing that goes around is k times the unit vector length. So the length is the unit vector root 3 times a times how many of them you have, which is n, and that's the wave vector. So the product of those things gives you 2 pi. Integral number of 2 pi. You've had that, I'm sure, in your course. Quantum mechanics, you've had that all kind of places. So we use that formula, and we plug that into the formula on the last view graph, which was for graphite. But now we have graphite that's been rolled up. So we have periodic boundary condition. And if you do that for the armchair tube, you get this formula. You just substitute this for k, the k vector in the last equation. And so armchair tube is right over here. So it gives you this E versus K. And you see it's a metallic tube because we have states going all the way down to K equals 0. There's a continuum of states. But and here's 9-0. You see, that one also makes a metallic too, because you have a continuum of states. But over here, 10-0, voila, something bad happens, and there's a gap. All right? So this one is semiconducting. And let me see if the next... the next one gives you the general formula, and then I'll explain how you get this formula. So here's the formula, that when n minus m, so those are the two integers that define, n and m define each nanotube. So when the difference between the integers is a multiple of 3, then we have a metal, and otherwise we have a semiconductor. So there are twice as many semiconducting as metallic tubes, as you can see from this formula. All right, so, and you go back to the past view graph, like this one here, you see that it obeys, say, the difference between n and m is 0 here, so that's got to be divisible by 3, and this is divisible by 3, and this one is not divisible by 3. So that's the way it works. But, of course, there's physics that proves, that shows this. All right, now here I have density of states. So the density of states, have you had that in your class? Density of states is the number of states per unit energy range. And for a low-dimensional system, you have these spikes. A one-dimensional system behaves like a molecule because it has spikes, just like a molecule has. It has very discrete energy levels, so you see them here. And this is a metallic tube, and you can see that immediately because there are states. There's no band gap. There's always states. But this is a semiconducting tube because in this place here, there are no states. So there's a energy gap without states, no allowed states. So this one is semiconducting, and that one is metallic. And so maybe that's all I'm going to say right now. And the density of states, well, yeah, I should say that this picture here of the density, the specific density of states, that is the energy at which all these spikes occur, is different for every NM nanotube. So in that sense, every NM nanotube is a different molecule because these energy eigenvalues is different for every nanotube. Yes?
Earlier, I thought the energy crossing was happening at the K point.
Yeah, well, at the K point is where it crosses in graphite. And that point in this picture would occur, correspond to the center of this place. Okay, and we're building up the energy levels away because we were doing these energy contours, remember? So that's for moving away from the K point. All right, I'm going to show more about that, time permitting. So now here I show only metallic nanotubes, but I show you what happens as we change the direction of the K vector. So here we have what's called the armchair direction. And as we move away from the K point to the left or to the right, you see perfect symmetry. And so that there's no splitting, these energy levels are just simple features. But over here, when we move away from the K point here, in this direction we get toward the gamma point. In that other direction, we get toward the M point eventually. In this direction, it's not symmetric and left to right. And because of that, every level splits. So you have a splitting because the cutting lines to the left and the cutting lines to the right are not symmetric. So the first cutting line to the left and the first cutting line to the right have about the same energy, not exactly, but about the same energy. But there's a difference, and you can measure that. And those splittings are what gives you the distinction from one nanotube to another. And because the energy levels are different, the properties are different. And that's one of the great things about nanotubes, but it's also one of the problems about nanotubes today, is that technology has not yet figured out how to separate these nanotubes according or control their growth for a specific NM. This will happen someday, but nobody has figured out yet how to do it. So, and one of the reasons it's hard is because, and you've seen this in the pictures, that you take a nanotube and you just vary the diameter and chirality by a very small amount so that the geometry has only changed a very, very little bit, but the properties change dramatically because to have a metallic tube, it's necessary for a cutting line to go through this K point. If the cutting line does not go through the K point, you don't have a metallic nanotube. All right, so onwards here. So this basically says the same thing. Here are the metallic nanotubes. And this shows you the orientation for a zigzag tube. So you could see going to the left or going to the right, you get different cutting lines. So this is going to have these splittings. You could see the splittings in the energy levels. Now, the next, I'm going to show you the same thing for a semiconducting tube. So you'll see something different now. Now, the cutting line. So here's the K point in the Brillouin zone. And you're going to, and here are two cutting lines. These are the two cutting lines that are closest to the K point. You see neither of them go through the K point. So this is going to be a semiconductor. In order to have a metallic tube, we have to have occupation of the state that's at the touching of the valence and conduction band. And when they don't touch, you can't have a metallic state because it's required for electrons to easily go from one energy to the next to have a metallic system. So this one is obviously going to be semiconducting. Now, one of the properties is that the K point will always be one-third of the distance of the separation between cutting lines. The separation between cutting lines is 2 over the diameter of the nanotube. So this distance is one-third of the separation between cutting lines. And the other one is two-thirds, so that the sum is equal to one-third plus two-thirds equals one. So that gives you the separation of the nanotube. But because for semiconducting tubes, going to the left and going to the right gives you something very different. In one case is one-third, in the other case is two-thirds. Very different energies. The smaller one gives you the first level, and the other one on the right gives you the second level. And then you have to wait a while to get to the next energy level is going to be the distance that's four-thirds the separation and five-thirds, etc. So that's the mathematics that goes into this. Maybe that's more than you want to hear, but it's all worked out very nice. Okay, a long time ago, this is 1992, the first nanotube that was ever made in the laboratory was 1993, but at least in our group, we wrote a whole mess of papers in 1992 about nanotubes because it was such an interesting mathematical thing. But we had no idea at the time that anybody would ever see these things. So when in 1993 this was observed experimentally in the laboratory, it became a lot more interesting and relevant. But we had a paper at a semiconductor, at a nanotube conference sponsored by NEC Corporation in Japan. And we said, oh, if you could make these things, it would be really great for a company like NEC because you can see here a coaxial cable, junctions, logical circuit with a transistor here, memory, put something inside, and you can imagine all kind of things. So we had visions. And some of these things have actually come true. Okay, now we're going to do transport properties real quick. So first thing to say is that the STM tip that we use, you can use it in the STS mode and actually probe the energy levels. And that's shown here. I mentioned that already. And that gives you a measure of the anisotropy. In practice, this is a very difficult experiment to do, and it's only been done a few times in history because it's hard to get a system that works well enough. And we actually study this by optics, where it's much easier to do the same thing. All right, now I'm going to talk about junctions. So if we take two different nanotubes and join them together, so we have a nanotube. Well, here's a schematic, a nanotube and another nanotube, and it's joined together. And that junction is made by mathematics, actually. So any two nanotubes, whatever they are, NM, N prime, M prime, any two nanotubes can be joined, and there's only one defect that's created, and 1-5-7 pair. And a pair means that you have, instead of a hexagon, you have one pentagon, and instead of a hexagon, you have a septagon, seven heptagon. You have seven-sided figure and a five, and that averages to six. And one defect like that is sufficient to join, mathematically, you can join any tube to any other tube. So that's a theorem that we have paper Yeah, that's a paper. You read that paper. Explain how that happens. So, but now for this is practice because you're engineers and you want to know what this is good for. So, if you join a metallic and a semiconducting tube, then you get a diode because electrons will not flow from the metallic tube into the semiconductor, but it'll go from the semiconductor to the metal. That's obvious. And so, okay, so that gives you a diode, and diode action is shown here with a gap, and then when you have enough voltage on it, it will overcome by a tunneling mechanism. And so you can make tunnel junctions, and you could see here, when you have your own version of this thing that we're putting on the web, you can see here is a two tubes joined together with a bend, and here's another bunch. So they make a junction like this. That's the story. And then if you do IV characteristics, current voltage characteristics, you see an onset of conductivity. And then if you get higher up, you get sort of like linear ohmic behavior, very far from the gap. And go through all of this quickly. So 5 years ago, 1998, first field effect transistor. This is one single nanotube, just one nanotube. And so it's wired between a source, electrode, and drain. So here are the physical manifestations, source and drain. Okay, and then we have a gate. Here's the back gate, and that's the gate. All right, so by varying source and drain, you can get like the diode action I mentioned. But then if you have a gate, then you can control what the current going through because the gate will change the energy levels. Now I'm going to show you how that happens very briefly. Not much time given to me. So again, here are a whole bunch of different phenomena. I have one view graph on each phenomenon because I have no time to give you much more. So I show you resonant tunneling, ballistic transport, single electron transistors, and then coupled events and field effect transistors. I show you all of that. So now we have, this is a relatively short nanotube, so that the nanotube has discrete energy levels. There they are. So if you have a relatively short nanotube, it's like a particle in a box. So a particle in a box will have discrete levels, and because the number of atoms that you have along the tube is not very large, you can distinguish the separation of the energy levels here was about 6 millivolts. That's plenty to measure. So they have here the energy levels. And now here's the source and drain. So if you change the relative voltage between them, like it's over here, then an electron from this electrode can tunnel across through this state in the nanotube and reach the other electrode. So you get a spike when this energy level of the nanotube is in the energy difference between the source and drain voltages. So if you manage to hit that, then you can have resonant tunneling. That's the condition of resonant tunneling for all low-dimensional systems. I'm sure that Professor Chen discussed that in some context. And so you vary what the gate voltage does is it moves these levels up and down. Doesn't change them, it just moves them up and down and gets them in the right spot, and you get a spike. And then the other thing you can do is you change the position of these without paying attention. The gate is a constant value, and that's shown over here. What that is going to do is change the size of the window. So you get small window, big window, and that's what's being measured over here. So, okay, that's the first, and then they have different temperatures over here, which this thing, you have to go to low temperature to see this effect very well. Obviously, thermal energy has to be much less than the separation between the energy levels of the nanotube, so you have to go down in temperature. All right, now, okay, this is quantization of conductance. Did you have that in your class? For a small system like a quantum wire, the conductance, you know Ohm's law. It says I and B are proportional to each other, and if you have a macroscopic system, there's a line between them. It's a constant value. That we call that the conductance. And but for a small system, that conductance is quantized, and it's quantized in units of E squared over H. So here's E squared over H, back 2E squared of H, spin up, spin down electrons, and this is the 13 kiloohms. Reciprocal value of that gives you the conductance. Kiloohms, of course, is a resistance. And so what these guys did in this experiment is they took, mercury. They had a little wire, and they had mercury pool, and they took the nanotube, and the nanotube goes into this liquid metal, and when it makes contact, then they can get an IV curve. So they measure, they put in a little bit, and then they go further in, so they get, like, the next shell and so forth. And so they show here the quantization of the conductance. You could see these steps. And they show that you, for a multi-walled nanotube, you can get quantized conductance. So this was demonstrated. One of the mysteries, and this remained a mystery for several years, it has to do with the fact that in nanotubes, I'll show you this in a moment, the nanotubes, the unit is twice larger than it is for ordinary systems, non-graphite related, non-nanotube systems. And that has to do with the fact that there's a K and a K prime point. People in my group know all about that. Because you have a hexagon, and every other point is unique. So the K and K points, K prime point have the same energies, but they differ by time reversal symmetry. You've heard us talk about that in group meeting. But too complicated for today. So another property of nanotubes is they have no backscattering. And they have no backscattering because of this degeneracy. So we have one of these K, E versus K, energy versus momentum, and graphite is linear in K. Very unusual for systems. Normally you have that the energy goes like K squared. That's what you've been raised on here in periodic systems. But graphite is very, very special because there's a degeneracy between the valence and conduction band. They touch each other, and that makes the energy levels linear in K. And for a system that's linear in K, there is no backscattering. And therefore, in normal system, you have the one wave vector that gets scattered the most is in the backward direction, and that gives rise to a phenomenon that we call weak localization. I don't know if you talked about that in your class, but no. But that's it's an important topic in solid-state physics about 30 years ago, but you know we still use it all the time now. But can't talk about everything here. No time. So, okay. But because the K and the K prime cancel each other with regard to these scattering events and magnetic field, which has to do with these conduction paths, nanotubes do not have the backscattering, and therefore you don't have localization. And this, the effect of this for device physics is that you can have much better conductance, you can have higher mobilities, and you can have something that's called ballistic transport. Let me talk about this. So here's ballistic transport, an example of ballistic transport. So we have a source and a drain, and we have a nanotube between them. And if the nanotube is set up in such a way that the length of the nanotube is an integral number of de Broglie wavelengths. So that's the wavelength of the electron wavelength. It has certain energy momentum. So when we have that, we can make a standing wave of the electron wave. It makes a standing wave. You know that an electron has particle aspects to it, and it has wave aspects. So the wave aspect is what we're talking about. And that effect shows up in nanotubes. And the reason you can see it in nanotubes better than other systems is because they have ballistic transport. That is, the electron will go along the length of the tube without being scattered. And the scattering only occurs at the junctions where you're at the electrodes. So it's interesting, very interesting system. And that was observed, about 4 years ago, 3 years ago. Another thing, this we spent a whole hour on this one view graph in a group meeting yesterday. I think you remember that. And this is, you have a source and a drain, and then you have an island. It is possible with a gate to control the flow of charge so that you have only the flow of one electron. And this is called a single electron transistor. And that was discovered, MIT was one of the places it was discovered, along with Bell Labs and maybe one other place in the world, about 15 years ago. A little bit less than 15 years ago. Well, you have that in nanotubes, and the way you'd make it is you have to put some kind of defect like that to create some kind of island. And then you control the tunneling between this piece of the nanotube and this one here in the island, and then eventually the other one. And this picture here delineates the inside of this picture is forbidden, and if your current voltage characteristics fall in that diamond, inside the diamond, there's no conductance. But outside the diamond, there is. And so here are the features of the tunneling conductance corresponding to these points shown here. So these are kind of experiments that are ongoing now. This is a couple of years old, observed for the first time. Now I'm going to talk about phonons and Raman spectra. How am I doing on time?
30 minutes.
Okay, well, we'll try. Pretty good, pretty good. It never has infinite conductance because if you make it really long, you're going to get some kind of scattering mechanism. You'll have defects in the nanotube. But it's carbon nanotubes have relatively few defects compared to other materials. Why is that? Well, you can prepare them rather well. The bonding of carbon is stronger than any other material. That helps you make a good sample. The second thing has to do with a very small carbon-carbon distance, which is about the smallest in nature. There are very, very few things that are so close in spacing. So the other atoms don't fit in. The only atoms that you can fit into that spacing between carbon atoms is boron and nitrogen. Nitrogen can only fit because you have a curved tube. But if you had a flat tube, it would only be boron. So that's the story. So because it's very hard to put impurities into the lattice, they tend to be fairly perfect. That promotes ballistic transport. And the absence of backscattering is another reason that you don't have so much scattering. But eventually, if you make them long enough, you're going to have scatterers. It's not a superconductor. But you can have, some 100 nanometers. So that's still 100 times the diameter of the tube. So that's pretty robust sample. Okay, let me move on because I still have two main topics to cover for you. So Raman spectroscopy is used throughout research on nanotubes. And the reason is it allows you to use light, which is a very gentle probe, and it doesn't disturb the nanotube, but it provides a lot of information. I forgot to make a figure of this. Raman scattering is light coming in. A photon comes in. It hits the material. A photon comes out so that there's a scattering, because Raman's scattering, so there's some scattering. Light comes out. But in the process of interacting with the material, a phonon, that is a lattice vibration, is either created or absorbed. Okay, so we can measure the phonon that's created or absorbed. We could always create a phonon at any temperature, but to absorb a phonon, we have to be a sufficiently high temperature so that there are phonons about. So the Stokes process is that for the emission of phonons, so that's always available. And at high temperatures, we could do anti-Stokes also. And then so we get both. Anti-Stokes is absorption of phonons. All right, so here is the spectrum. So there's a Raman spectrum. And we have, this is the vibration where the two nearest neighbor carbon atoms are going like this. So that's always available. And the frequency at which that happens is almost identical to that of graphite, so we call a G for graphite feature. So that's called G-band, like graphite. And then we have another thing that's the radial breathing mode that's only observed for nanotubes. And that's where every atom on the nanotube is coherently going in and out, like breathing motion, so in the radial direction. So we call that radial breathing mode. And when you see that feature on a Raman spectrum of a carbon system, it's got to be a nanotube. So we use that as an identification mark of when your sample has a nanotube. If it doesn't have that, it probably isn't a nanotube sample. It's just carbon that has this guy here. All right, so that's one of the things. And then there's another factor. It's a resonant process that we see the Raman spectra. So because of that, the process is diameter selective. And because it's a one-dimensional system, the multiplication factor of this effect is many orders of magnitude, and it allows us to see just one single nanotube. It's so intense. So, that's one of the things that we discovered a number of years ago, and we use that. And so we look for a diameter and chirality-dependent phonons, and I introduce you to a few of the unusual things. So you've seen this picture before. This has to do with the structure of the nanotube. We see here that the unit cell for the nanotube is very much larger than the unit cell for graphite, which is just one hexagon. Here it's many hexagons. So that because of that, you know from your basic course here that Professor Chen told you that the number of atoms that you have in your unit cell will have 3 degrees of freedom, X, Y, and Z. So because of that, if we have 2 atoms per unit cell for graphite, then you'll have 6 degrees of freedom. But for the nanotube, you have a huge number of atoms in the unit cell, so that the phonon spectrum will be very complicated. We have many, many modes. So what are we going to do? And this is sort of, N tells you the number of hexagons that you have in your unit cell. So you can determine all of that. Here's graphite with the 6 modes, 2 atoms per unit cell. So 2 times 3 is 6. You count them up, you'll see that there are 6. And so 3 of them are acoustic, though shown here, and 3 of them are optical. And here is the density of states for the phonons. And you can see some spikes along here. And the spikes are maintained when you make the nanotube and you roll this thing up to make nanotube. Yeah?
How do we measure phonons?
You measure by the frequency. Okay? You have a sample, and you shine light in, and you look at the scattered light. And you measure the shift in phonon frequency. That shift in phonon frequency corresponds to the phonon that was created in the material. Okay? That's the way it works. And from that, we measure. So here's the phonon spectrum. So it looks like a terrible mess. But there are only a few phonon frequencies that are important. This radial breathing mode and this G-band, which consists of these, you see that they're almost the same frequency, these 3 different things. It has total symmetry, no nodes, 2 nodes, and 1 node. You don't have to go into those details. Too much details for you now. But they're all at about the same frequency. But this little picture shows you all of them together, because this is the very first paper, and we noticed that the line shape was complicated. And that's because that there are all these different possible modes that you can get by, but they have the same frequency approximately. So this is a big blow up of this feature. And here's a radial breathing mode. And here are all the different features that you have. You have a D band that has to do with disorder. So we can tell if the sample is disordered, if it has defects, if it has impurities, if whatever it has, vacancies. Whatever it has, you can tell that from the Raman spectra by looking at this feature. And these little guys here are new physics. I had no time to discuss with that. And then the second harmonic of this is always seen, and we use that to get a lot of important information. And, okay, next view graph shows you that this process is diameter selective because if you change the energy of the laser that excites the a Raman process, the spectrum changes dramatically. The frequency of the radial breathing mode is very different for each of these laser energies, and the intensities are very different. So from that, we concluded in the first paper correctly that the process has to be resonant, that we see the spectrum only when the laser energy matches the energy difference between one of these spikes in the valence band and another spike in the conduction band. Now, you remember that the energy of these spikes are unique for each nanotube. Every nanotube, special nanotube, NM nanotube, has different spikes. So if we measure these energies, and that's the resonance energy, then we know which nanotube we have because we can calculate. Now, this goes to making models here. Oh, we don't. This is not it. This explains, reminds you again that at 2 electron volts, like a red or green light, we're in a very warped situation. So when we look at a nanotube with light, each nanotube looks very different because of this trigonal warping effect. So we take advantage of that, and we make this plot. So this is like the first level from the top of the valence band level to the top first conduction level, and this is the second one. These are for semiconducting tubes. This is for metallic tubes. And then this is the third one for semiconducting, fourth one, etc. And this is the range of diameters for a sample that we might make in the laboratory. This is for a real sample was done. And this is the spectra that we're taking. So when we're at low energy, so we're over here, we're taking a constant energy across this way, we only see semiconducting tubes. Then we go up in energy, we get into around 2 eV, is around 2 eV. So then we're in resonance with these metallic tubes and line shape changes. So that's the signature that we have metallic tubes. Then we go up in energy, and then again we're in resonance with semiconducting tubes. So the line shape goes back to look like this. So we can use this as an indicator of whether we have semiconducting or metallic tubes. And this shows that the sensitivity is so large that we could see spectrum from just one nanotube. So this is spectrum taken from one semiconducting nanotube. So there's a radial breathing mode. There's a G band, the D band. There's a G prime, this is the second order of this. And here's the corresponding thing for just one nanotube that's metallic. So it gives you an idea of what we can do. And we use these spectra, the energy at which they occur, and the frequency of the radial breathing mode to tell us which tube we have from that plot that I showed you on the previous view graph that plots diameter versus energy. So this, it's a simple and direct way to do all of that. Well, this is just to show you more about the technology of how we do it. And this is how do we do the experiment with a continuous laser. So then we can get the line shape, and we show that the line shape is not symmetric, and it gives you information about the nature of the singularity that you have for one-dimensional systems, which would be different if you had, say, a quantum dot. That would be symmetric. Yes?
So without doing any Raman, if you just look at these things under a microscope and do reflections across?
Well, you can't do much if you have a real small object, you know the wavelength of light is many nanometers.
You wouldn't see any features, but can you at least see a line of...
You can if you have a long tube. Okay. You have to have some feature that matches the wavelength of light. And so, and usually we have tubes that are several microns long, so we could see them. But if you have a short tube, you can't see it. You need electron beam, and you can't see it with photon beam. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to go through this real quick. This is another method that we use to get accurate energies. You know with spectroscopy you can measure energies very accurately. Here we go with creation and annihilation of a phonon, and we can measure the energy which it happens. These things have very interesting polarization effects, and this slide goes into that. All of these things can be an hour lecture, every one of these slides. And this one here explains about the zone folding and these cutting lines. I was explaining about these energy eigenvalues that you have where you have a continuum of states. So the very first one has A1 symmetry, total symmetry, and then we have 2 nodes, 4 nodes, 6 nodes, etc., as we go from the left to the right. And these are the only ones that are Raman active. So most of the modes will not be seen by the Raman effect, which is very nice for us because it makes the spectrum very simple, relatively simple. Okay, and when you work at the single nanotube level, you can get a lot of information. So this shows you can get the dependence of certain modes on diameter, chirality. You can do it for all the features. And not even all this work has been done. Some of it has been done, but field is pretty young, so there's a lot still to be done. This shows how we can measure experimentally the trigonal warping. I showed you these surfaces have a warping effect as we go out in energy. Well, it was measured by the Raman effect on nanotubes. In fact, that wasn't even known for graphite very well, so we measured it this way. And now we measured the same thing for the vibrations. We can do that by sticking to a particular phonon and then going out in function of angle. And this is what happens with the intermediate modes, frequencies. So we have, this is our latest frontier. We don't understand all the things about this. But there are some modes that are infrared active, but they can be seen on the Raman effect because of the chirality dependence. It breaks the inversion symmetry, so we can see these modes, and we're studying those in the laboratory right now. This is one of our very latest works, 2004, and here's one nanotube that's suspended between two posts, and it's not on the substrate at all, and in this way it's sort of isolated from any environment, and we hope with experiments like this that we can get information that's not available up till now. And it shows that the radial breathing mode is very, very, very strong. You can see how sharp and strong it is. And then the intermediate mode frequencies, which are almost not seen in general when it's on a substrate, come out. This is multiplied by a factor of 30 or 50, but you could see them and measure them. So that's what we're doing now. And then we can combine Raman with other things, as you see here. So here are two electrodes, say source and drain. Okay, you can have that. And then we have the suspended tube, and then we have the light coming in here. So we could apply voltage across here to do transport, imagine all kind of experiments, and then we can characterize what nanotube we have with light, with optics. So that's another thing that we do now. And another thing that we have is, this is very recent, emission. These nanotubes will emit light. And so if you excite them, so here's with, say, blue laser, and then you watch the emission at a lower energy, red laser, red energy, red light coming out, then there will be some special frequency that a given phonon will be excited because of these unique density of states. I showed you the energy levels of each nanotube is unique. And they form these spots. So for certain excitation energy, there'll be emission at a particular energy. And we can use that combination of coordinates to tell us which tube we have. And those energies correspond exactly to the same energies that we have from the Raman. And we've verified that they are the same. So this gives you another way to do the experiment. And this has some advantage because on the same sample, say in a solution, you can measure all the different levels in your sample. With Raman, you have to go one by one. Here you can do all of them. So this has some advantage. Calibration with this is kind of difficult. So some of the challenges with carbon nanotubes is how to produce the same one every time, how to control the synthesis method, and how to figure out exactly what you have. So we have been working with different people who develop. So the top is chemists, and they have some kind of chemical that will stick better on the semiconducting rather than the metallic ones. So that gives you a separation method, a chemical separation method. It works so-so. I mean, this is, a lot of work has to be done before this is really good. And this is one that we work with a lot more. This is wrapping with a biological element. This is a DNA strand. And that works the best of anything that we have so far in separating nanotubes. And it's allowed us to do some new science that we never thought we could do. So we've been very pleased about having that. So finally, applications. How am I on time? Yeah? Not bad. So, last topic. I'm sorry that this is so fast, but to get all of this in one lecture. One thing after I finished doing the lecture that I realized that I didn't do for you and your mechanical engineers, I should have something on thermal transport, and that's a subject I know a lot about. But there's relatively not much information about that on nanotubes. There's some, but that's about the weakest area. So a good place for mechanical engineers. There's a lot to be done in the area of trying to understand thermal conductivity of nanotubes, which is they're probably the best thermal conductor of any material out there, which is an advantage for some things, but maybe a disadvantage for other things. So, but it is unique in being very large. So, okay, I have a few things on applications. So this is a smorgasbord of so you can make tips, AFM tips. We talked about that before. And because the tip can be so thin and so narrow, it can go into very small crevices because the mechanical properties are so wonderful of nanotubes. You can work with one single individual nanotube and make a tip of that, and that's very sensitive. Here's your single nanotube transistor, field effect transistor. Here's a field emitter. The tip of the nanotube is one of the best emitters of electrons. So this is being developed by Samsung and other companies as well for a flat panel display, but it's not yet commercialized. It's very close because we see demonstrations all the time at conferences, but it's not being sold yet. And I think the reason has to do with other competing technologies that the same companies are developing, and they have to see which is the best for them. Here's the imaging of an AFM tip, and you can see the resolution is very good. Here's 10 nanometers, and you can see some details. New materials. The holes of the nanotube, the inside, could be filled with different molecules like fullerenes is here. I explained that. But you can put many, many things. There are about 100 different species. So you can make single crystals. There was a guy over there that was asking about that. A single crystal of something. You were asking about carbon. But you can put many different, like alkali halide or whatever you want, and make just a single row of atoms. And the properties obviously are very different than they are in a bulk crystal, and people have been studying that. So that's very interesting. The money makers are fillers for enhancing the lifetime of lithium-ion batteries, and there's some 300 million of these made every year. So this is big business. And filling for polymer composites. Actually, this is not only lithium-ion batteries, but it's been extended now to the batteries for your car. The lead-acid batteries are going to have nanotubes also. So, and what they do, they're very prosaic application, that the nanotubes are used for maintaining the separation of different components in the battery, the electro parts. When you charge and discharge, there's a small change in distance of the electrodes. Not big, it's a very small change. But after discharging and charging for 1,000 times, that begins to add up and you begin to get some shorting and breakdown of the batteries. And then you throw away your battery. It's a lithium-ion battery. But what the nanotube does is it maintains that distance so it can be used for 3 times as long approximately. So that's why it's in your batteries. You don't know it, but it's there. Okay, here's about the strength. You're a mechanical engineer, so you'll be interested in this. They have a very high Young's modulus, and this gives you some nanotubes, single-wall carbon nanotubes, relative to other things. And when you do it on a weight basis, it's even more wonderful. And this one is tensile strength, which is also very high. And this is density. Density is very low, so that's why it's... The predecessor of carbon fibers has been used in the space industry from its inception. You wouldn't have a space industry without carbon fibers and carbon materials. So, and that's how one of the reasons I make contacts with it myself. So this is a picture. The U.S. version of this picture is the space elevator. I mean, I guess a lot of you have seen that. It's similar to this. This is Japanese version of it. I have a Japanese collaborator. He gives me view graphs. And here's the application to hydrogen storage. I've been involved with this quite a bit myself. And the story about, as you know, for a hydrogen economy, et cetera, that people talk about storing hydrogen. And carbon nanotubes is really quite good. It's as good as liquid hydrogen, approximately. Can get carbon to hydrogen ratios of about 1, which is quite good, but it's not good enough. It's only liquid hydrogen only has 8.5% hydrogen by weight, but the Department of Energy requires in 10 years that it be roughly 10%. So we have to do something better. So carbon nanotubes is just not going to make it on that scale if we want to drive 500 miles without refueling. The physics is wrong because the hydrogen molecule is separated, two hydrogen atoms are separated by too big a distance. We have to make a new kind of hydrogen that brings them a little closer. So we don't know how to do that yet. Well, under pressure, of course, you can do, but it's not enough to be interesting. All right, another application. Here's the flat panel display. And this works pretty well because the carbon nanotubes can grow. You put down a catalyst, and where the catalyst is put down, the carbon nanotube grows. So that determines the position, and it will grow straight up from the substrate. So you get them growing like a forest of trees. So that's very, very a nice kind of thing for doing patterning. And then you could make a red and green and blue, and that's what Samsung does. And so you can have all the colors and for your TV screen, color TV. And so this shows you about the phosphorus. So the electrons, they don't have color, but they hit phosphors that do, so that the light coming through this to hit the flat panel display is colored in this way. That's the system, how that works. And, well, because the nanotubes are so small and you can pack the information in such a small space, you can get high resolution. So it gives you a high resolution screen. That's why they like it. And the screens that they have at Samsung are gigantic. They're more than this, is what they show in their demo. More than a meter. Really big screens. All right, here are a few more things. Here are the tips. Here's a single tip attached to a silicon. So this is the usual tip, and then they attach, imagine glue or something, they put on here, and that's one nanotube. And that's how they get that really high resolution images that I show you over here. So, for example, if you have a system like this, so it has kind of a deep but very thin separation. This is only a few nanometers. You can never see that with an ordinary tip of an AFM. It just won't go in there, but a nanotube will. And so you can get the correct positioning. And here is done on some biological system. This is double helix. And you can tell in the individual components of the double helix as you go around in this paper a few years ago. And this is a manipulator of a nanotube. So there's a company called Zyvex that's in Texas. I think it's in Texas. Pretty sure it's Texas. And so they take the nanotube, the two ends, and they pull on it, and then they can manipulate, move here, there. And that's the way the machine looks. I've seen that also at conferences being demonstrated. And this is the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Some guy is using this something that's like this machine to manipulate nanotubes on substrates. So, and they cut them. And we do that here at MIT, too. Many of these things are done at MIT in different labs, like cutting. You make them real short. They make them like 100 nanometers or less with lithography. And this is work of IBM. See, IBM, they make real circuits because they want to make computers out of this stuff. So so they start out with a multi-wall nanotube, and they'll peel off the individual walls of the nanotube until they're down to one wall. And they had a paper, that's the paper a few years ago, that shows how they peel off each individual one, and they can measure which ones are semiconducting, metallic, and characterize them. So it's kind of interesting. But they actually, what they were using this for was to make a transistor. So they just take a pile of ordinary nanotubes. They don't separate them at all. But they use this process to separate out the nanotubes they want. And they burn off all the metallic ones. They're left with the semiconducting ones. They bring them over and they place them where they want them. And they make transistors. So that's what they tell you about in that paper. So I'm all finished. 2:30, not too bad. And so I said something in my talk about symmetry, geometry, and described NM, which is kind of the basis for explaining about the different molecules that nanotube. A nanotube is a solid-state molecule. It has energy levels like a molecule, but then it has a continuum, a V versus K, along the length. So therefore, it has some solid-state properties. That makes it a unique and interesting system. And so it has a special electronic structure that could either be metallic or semiconducting. As you notice, when a cutting line goes through that capital K point, then we have metallic state. Otherwise, we have a semiconducting one. And if we could only figure out some kind of way to control that in the laboratory when we make them, nanotubes will be a lot more interesting commercially. We could do that. So then we use resonance Raman spectroscopy because it's such a powerful tool. Everybody uses it. Nobody makes nanotubes hardly without doing some Raman spectra on it. So I said that, talked about that. And then a little bit about applications. So we hope that someday nanotubes will have many applications. We need applications in nanoscience. And this one is considered one of the most promising approaches. But nobody yet, other than in lithium-ion batteries as fillers or in fillers and polymers, nobody's made big money on this. But we hope someday, maybe somebody in this room will figure out some really blockbuster application. Now, we think that the properties of these things are so different than anything else in nature that something useful should be possible, but we're still waiting for the right idea. Okay, that's all I have for this class. Thank you.